guys, Phil Mulkey, your host for Love of the Game Summit podcast and our new live stream series. And I'm super excited to circle back with Duff Gibson for our chat today and talk about all the amazing work that he's done as a former Olympian, winning gold in world championships in skeleton, as well as coaching at the Olympic level for a number of years, and precursor to that, founder of, or tying in with it, founder of Dark Horse Athletics, promoting multi-sport physical literacy. We were mentioning just before we jumped on, we both are drinking the Kool-Aid. We're both in the same state. This conversation I'm really, really pumped about because I think we're going to have lots of great nuggets. But he has recently written and released a book called The Tao of Sport, which he graciously sent me a copy of. I had an opportunity to read it. Absolutely brilliant. And I highly encourage those of you that are watching, you definitely got to move it to the right place. Definitely want to pick up a copy because it's got so many great nuggets in. So, Duff, thanks for joining us today, and I'm looking forward to having a great chat.
Well, my pleasure, Glenn. I'm looking forward to it. I very much enjoyed our last one, and I've tried to share on social media all your links and this talk because I think I admire you said we're both drinking the Kool-Aid. I think it's a really important topic, and I wish you had a worldwide exposure. So let's see if we can build a few viewers today.
Trying to get there. And we have actually had people, and I know that you signed up for one of our original live events. I've had people sign up for events from all over the place, like Australia, New Zealand, many parts of Europe. We had somebody in from Germany, like in a crazy time difference when we did the summit. Lots of people from Canada, the U.S. It takes time to build that, you know, that critical mass. But the more people that we reach out to, the more people I think will hopefully start moving the needle in the right direction. So before we get into the current with the book and everything that you've done before that, maybe for those that didn't check out the prior podcast, which I think is 3 years ago. 2 years ago, at least.
It all blends together for me.
Yeah. Maybe give us a little insight. Like, tell us your story. Where did you grow up? And what did you play as a kid?
Right. Well, I grew up in Toronto, a suburb of various suburbs of Toronto at different times. And it was sort of the simultaneous dream for me to play for the Leafs or to play in the NHL. And then I watched the Montreal Olympics around my 10th birthday and had simultaneously, and I mentioned this in the book, I don't know if you remember, had a volleyball coach in elementary school who was a referee at the Montreal Olympics. So that, I wonder if that sort of helped that Olympic dream grow and develop or was verified or reinforced right when I had just watched the Montreal Olympics and I was fully captivated by it and wanted to be a part of it and didn't care what sport it was, whether it was volleyball or I tried 5 different sports each time thinking this is the sport that's going to take me to the Olympics and I'm going to represent Canada. And that was beginning with wrestling in high school and then rowing in university and following rowing. When I moved to Calgary originally, it was right after the 88 Olympics. And I thought, well, speed skating, that's going to be my sport, and then bobsleigh and skeleton. Now, with my kids' multi-sport program, part of my, you run a new session, you want to introduce yourself to the kids, I give 5 kids a chance to guess a sport that I've never done before. So and there are some correct answers out there, and the repeat customers sort of know what those, you know, like synchronized swimming or figure skating, equestrian is one. But there aren't too many of them. So that, to answer your question, I am a multi-sport athlete and I've tried a lot of things at least once.
And a big challenge that we face in this space, and I know that's the reason why at Dark Horse we're doing multi-sport programming, is the challenge that we faced on the specialization model, which you don't do a deep dive in your book, but it's really become problematic. And like, I just came off a whirlwind fall, just like last fall, running a whole whack of online coaching clinics for hockey. It's amazing how many of these coaches say, oh, you know, we got to make sure we wrap these kids up for spring and doing all the summer development. Whoa, 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 whoa. Let's scale that back. Like, hang up the skates in March, and shift to lacrosse or baseball or something. Just get away from the rink so they miss it and hopefully build athletic skills. And you're the perfect testimonial. You hop from one to one to, and you did it at the highest level. Like, how do you shift from bobsleigh national? Then all of a sudden, oh, new skeleton. Like, what was that all about?
Well, for a lot of them, you know, the argument has always been that sports like hockey and soccer are so technically demanding that it's a different thing. The sports that I did, like rowing, for example, there is very obviously a technical component, but with a certain level of training, once you get, you know, once you're a couple years in, the technical aspect is pretty solid. So the technique is not what separates the, you know, the top rowers from the good rowers. I would say with bobsleigh and skeleton, it's the same concept. It's the same training. There's a great deal of overlap there. There's success in both of those sports has a great deal to do with learning the pressures and the very minute details of the different tracks. And so there's a lot of crossover there. When it comes back to hockey, that's a different thing. And as I wrote in the book, I think you see people, just as you described, trying to get kids to do more and more and more hockey because in the short term it works. You know, the best 6-year-old is the kid who started at 2 and does it every day. That's the best 6-year-old. Now that has no implication as to who the best 18 or 20 or 30 year old will be, but it works in the short term. And that's why I think that one is a hard one to dissuade parents and coaches on.
Yeah, I can agree with you more. I mean, the German studies where they showed, you know, the 11, 12, 13 year olds were as a result of that model. But then once they got to 17, 18, the horse, you know, the rabbit and the tortoise analogy, the tortoise caught up to the rabbits or the hares, for lack of a better word. So shifting gears and trying a whole bunch of different sports early on, I'm a big advocate for. I know you're a big advocate for. I know you do amazing work with the Dark Horse program. So, but today is all about the book, the amazing book. First question, what planted the seed for you to write it? And then second question, how long did it take to write it?
Well, it's if I just compiled the amount of minutes I was actually writing and working on the book, it might have been, I don't know, a year. Maybe you could compress that all into a year, but that was spread out over, you know, certainly well before the Vancouver Olympics. So you could say 12 or 15 years that I, a lot of it was from a blog that I used to work on. And the motivation for the book in general, sort of there's sort of two components to that. One was, as I described earlier, being a fan and being obsessed with the Olympics from the age of 10 and going, moving to Calgary and working under Dr. David Smith and having access to all those national teams as a student and then an athlete and then a coach. And now I'm not involved with high performance sport at all. I'm involved with development sport for kids. And so much of what I have is this great knowledge that has taken decades to learn. Some of those lessons I didn't learn until after I was an athlete. And in Calgary, in particular, for Winter Olympic sport, although I do reference a number, you know, I have friends who are summer sport athletes also, but it's really this incredible hotbed of Olympic sport. And some of the most iconic Canadian Olympians are Calgarians of my generation that I've had conversations with about the mental aspects of sport. And now that I've sort of moved past this, I wanted to make sure that some of those lessons were passed along. So that was the original impetus for starting the book. And then I began to watch my own kids participate in sport. And there was one moment in particular that was really a watershed moment when my youngest son, who's 14 now, but when he was 8, we were driving home from a hockey game, and he, without us talking about it, without us prompting him in any way, he said, "Man, my coach takes this way too seriously." And it just occurred to me that the behavior that I saw from that coach, I had just come back from the Sochi Olympics, which is the highest, you know, for my sport, that's the highest level you can go to. And we would never have tolerated that. Like, we literally, I would have had the complete backing of my federation and the CEO of Bobsleigh Canada Skeleton to remove someone for the behavior that I saw at my eight-year-old son's hockey game. And so why does that exist? Why, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And so that was sort of the impetus for Dark Horse, but it also morphed into the message of the book, because I think so much of what's wrong with youth sport, or the professionalization of youth sport, as a lot of people refer to it as, comes from a desire that we want our kids to be great, and we want to push them, and we want them to learn those lessons, and we want them to be tough, mentally tough. And sometimes we do that in a manner that backfires. And I watched my eight-year-old playing hockey, and I thought, if they're doing this trying to make our kids mentally tough, they're going about it the wrong way, and there's no need for it. And we're driving kids out of sport. And so I talk a lot about, I mean, the Tao of Sport is really a lot about high performance sport, but it translates so much into the foundation. There's such an overlap there that I always find that I'm saying, yeah, but if this is what a high performance mindset is, and I have to stop myself and think, well, why does youth sport exist in the first place? Well, it's not to streamline kids to the NHL or to the Olympics. It's about active and healthy lifestyle and learning life lessons and the joy of physical activity. But if the reason why we're going down this path is because we want our kids to be high performance, then we're screwing it up and we're driving kids out of sport. And so that's sort of the angle. That's sort of part two for the Tao of Sport.
And the reality of the percentages of those that are in the grassroots level that go on to the level that you achieved is a very, very small percentage. Like in professional sport, and I know this statistic from basketball and soccer and hockey, it's 0.03% of the participants at the minor level will go on to play professionally. Less than 1% will go on and get that NCAA Division I scholarship. Yet there's a high percentage of parents, and interestingly enough, one of the studies I've shared in a lot of my talks, I think it was TD Ameritrade did this study about 5 years ago, surveyed parents, you know, why are you not investing money in your retirement? And they said, a lot of our disposable income is going to support our kids playing sports. Okay, so what's your expectation from those sports? And the percentages of parents that were expecting their kids to play was totally disproportionate to what the reality was. Like over 40% play professionally, over 40% NCAA scholarship. But what got me was 34% were expecting their kids to represent their countries in the Olympics. That was like, whoa, that was an eye opener for me. So what is the reality of at the Olympic level? It's probably 0.05%, like you were at the creme la creme, the top of the top.
I don't honestly know, because it's for a lot of sports, it's very skewed in the sense that for skeleton, for example, it's not a mass participation sport. So we don't, you know, in bobsleigh, you could say exactly the same thing. You get people who were great football players or track athletes or something, or throwers sometimes, which is track and field, who come into the sport, are recruited to join the sport knowing they're going to be great at it, because that's why they're targeted. But there are very few people in skeleton and bobsleigh who do it recreationally. So there isn't a huge pool of which a small number make it. It's really one of those things where you don't do it unless you've got a chance. So I'm not entirely sure, you know, if you were talking about basketball or track or something that's more mass sports participation, then you'd get a more accurate result there.
And how many of the Olympians that you related to were multi-sport athletes like yourself? Most.
Well, it's to the point where if you look at the stats for football, NFL football, it's almost everybody, because almost everybody does football and track. In bobsleigh and skeleton, it's every single person, because there's no one who grows up thinking I'm going to be a skeleton person, because you're not allowed to even take the driver's school until you have a driver's license. So there are kids who are excited about it, interested in it, want to go see it, want to try it, but you don't do nothing because you can't even start it until you're later on. Now, it reminds me, and I mentioned this in the book, of the survey that was published in 2014 by the U.S. Olympic Committee. You're familiar with that one?
The number of Olympian athletes that were multi-sport, is that the one?
Yeah, or the average, as they, you know, it's not a study so much as a survey of Olympians. So they had the 2012 summer, this is Team USA, 2012 summer Olympians, 2010 winter Olympians, and it went back for 10 years. So I'm not sure, there might have been two summer, two winter, and on average to age 14, 12 or 14, Olympians did on average three sports.
Yeah.
And then to age 18, they averaged a little over two sports. And then after age 18, the average was still, it was like 1.1 or 1.2. So the average Olympian was on average was more than one sport, even beyond age 18. So that's got to tell you something. And there's even for super technical sports like hockey, you see the difference, and you see, you know, one of the Sutter brothers wrote an article that was in the Edmonton Journal and got a lot of attention. This would be 4 or 5 years ago, because he said, I can tell the difference. I can tell the kids who only played hockey, and I can tell the kids who played multi-sport. And it had to do with athleticism. It had to do with how often they were injured. And it had, in simple terms, it had to do with how they performed in novel situations. And the example I use in the book is a clip that you can Google of Steve Stamkos skating behind the net. A shot is taken, and I think it goes off the goalie's blocker or something. It goes straight up in the air, and Stamkos skates around the net, and there is, in the video, it's kind of cool because there's the post is there and the goalie's standing here, and Stamkos chokes up on his stick like a baseball bat, and he bunts it right out of the air into the net. And it's, the point is that you would never practice that in a million years of hockey practices. A coach never throws a puck up in the air and says, okay, try and bunt that into the net. So you've got to learn that somewhere. You've got to, you know, that's a novel environment. And so the more athletic you are, the better you are in novel environments. You know, aside from the, you know, the injury rates and the burnout rates and all that stuff, which is also undeniable. It's also, if you just play hockey, you're not as good a hockey player as you would have been if you played many things.
Yeah, and Mr. Crosby has done a few of those goals as well. But yeah. Backing up, and you're seeing some craziness. They call it a cross goal, where they're picking the puck from behind the net and tucking it in, and that's trying to swing over from across. And I mean, we could talk for hours probably of all the different examples of the cross training. I mean, you're a perfect example. You played other sports that set you up for success in skeleton and bobsleigh. Yeah. What do you think was the main sport that gave you that? And I just think about 120 kilometers or thereabouts an hour to overcome that fear, because I don't know if I could do what you did. Like, that's crazy fast.
Well, it's one of those things where it's scary the first 400 times you do it. And then, you know what I mean? And it's also, the skeleton is, I tell people it's like that. You know, I'm in Calgary. So the Calgary Stampede, whatever, if you go to a fair and you have that ride that sort of spins like this and you're standing up and then it goes faster and faster and then it tilts up on its side and the bottom drops out. Do you know that one I'm referring to? It probably has different names everywhere. And you look at it. Do you know what I mean? You know what I'm saying, though? It's you're standing up and you're going in a circle like this. Yeah. And the bottom drops out and it turns up on its side. And when you watch it, that's like watching skeleton. You say, that's, look how high they are up. They could fall. They could hurt themselves. And when you do it, you realize you're not going anywhere. So there is a little bit of that factor. It's not quite as bad as it looks, which isn't to say that you couldn't hurt yourself. Obviously you could, but your chin is literally an inch from the ground. And if you wanted to make sure, like this is something that skeleton sliders do, if you want to make sure that you're nice and low and aerodynamic, sometimes you'll just go like this and touch your chin to the ice to make sure you're in exactly that right spot. Well, it's not your chin, right? It's the chin guard. It's the chin protection on your helmet. So you don't have any distance to fall because you're already on the ground. So the fear part of it, I always say there were moments when I wouldn't say I was scared, but the track had my complete and undivided attention.
Yeah, I imagine it would. We've got comments are starting to fill in and some questions. So the answer to what that ride is, Gravitron. Thanks, Kerry, for that. Or Zolt is another one. Thanks,
yep, Ted. Yep.
And Ted actually put a question in. As the questions come up, I want to just kind of share them with you. How was your journey of sport that helped you as a firefighter and a leader in the workplace? Because I never even set this up that your day job has been firefighting all this time.
Well, that's a question I've been asked many times in the past. And I apologize to say that I don't really have a wonderful answer to it. Or the question is typically phrased, what commonalities are there between firefighting? And like, because they both appear to be a daredevil kind of a thing. And I don't see either of them as really being that way. And if there was something in common, it would be the preparation. It would be the mental rehearsal or the physical rehearsal. With firefighting, you don't get to practice putting out a fire very often. So we set controlled fires in concrete structures in specific rooms, and sometimes we'll even blindfold ourselves, excuse me, to simulate what it would be like in the real world. And that's sort of the commonality. You mentally rehearse and you mentally rehearse. And with skeleton, it's the same thing. You try to do, you watch a video, you stand beside the track, you stand in the track, when you're mentally rehearsing, you're moving your body and you're doing the movements that you do to steer a skeleton sled for the purpose of making the mental rehearsal as realistic as possible. The same way with firefighting, you set an actual fire of a hay bale, but it's in a concrete structure. You know, it's not going anywhere. Maybe you blindfold yourself to simulate what it would be like with a room full of smoke, that kind of thing, to try your best to simulate the real world as it might happen. That might be the biggest commonality, that you can't do. We get 6 training runs before a World Cup, for example. If we go to a location, we'll get 2 training runs a day for 3 days, and then we have to race. And so that's on average, a track in the world somewhere is about a minute long. So you get 6 minutes of actual practice before a race. And so mentally, you practice hours and hours and hours because that's your best preparation. And that's probably the biggest overlap between firefighting and skeleton.
A great answer. And it just reinforces the importance of visualization and imagery, which is a lot of what you cover in the book and talking about that whole mental side. I love the quote, I think it was Jack Nicklaus, what's really important is the 6 inches between your ears. That's what wins golf tournaments, right? Because it's that overall overcoming the pressure, and you made it to the podium, both world championships and Olympics. So maybe talking about your Olympic journey, which one was your favorite and why?
Between the world and the Olympics?
The Olympics themselves. You were at 2, right?
Oh, I see. Well, that's a pretty easy answer. One was, you know, you hear athletes talk about the post-Olympic depression. And after 2002, I finished 10th. I was in 5th place after the first run. And I really thought I had a chance at the podium because I was only in my 2nd year of skeleton. I had done a lot of years of bobsledding before that. So I don't want to pretend that I was the 2nd year ever doing it. I had years of experience, but I had only been on the national team for 2 years. And I just won my first World Cup medal in the World Cup immediately before the Olympics. And then to finish 10th was really a downer. But then that became the motivation for me. And I remember the guy who won, I saw him the next morning at the track. We were there watching another event and just sort of disappointed with how it went. And I saw the guy, an American guy by the name of Jim Shea, won my event in 2002. And he was talking with his coach. And he said, you know, when it started snowing that morning, I knew we had nailed it. And what he was talking about was the equipment that they had chosen for those race conditions. And I had, and this is sort of an idea that I brought with me from bobsleigh. I had a race set of runners and a training set of runners. And my race set of runners I used for every set of conditions on every track. And when this guy said, oh, I knew we nailed it when I chose those runners and I saw it was snowing in the morning, I realized that I wasn't preparing to the best of my ability. And so that became a huge motivator for me, and that just snowballed moving forward. And so that Olympics was depressing for a short time, but then it became a motivation. And the Torino Olympics, where I won gold, I was very aware of the fact that the planets needed to align. You do your best, you train, you visualize for hours and hours and hours, and you train for years to get there. I don't want to undervalue that. But you also are, you didn't choose the demands of that track. And the demands of that track suited my style perfectly. And it's also the nature of skeleton is very much, I draw a parallel with downhill skiing, in that a very small mistake not only takes you out of the medals, but out of the top 10. You know, and it's, if you're skiing, if you're a skier, you know this, you can carve or you can get a little bit too perpendicular and now you're breaking. And it's the same with skeleton. So a very little mistake and you're out of it. So I wasn't even dreaming of a gold medal. I was dreaming of a medal and to have my best performance. And it turned out better. You know, I exceeded my expectations and it was a dream come true. So that was the highlight of my career, obviously.
So circling back to the referee in volleyball, it kind of planted the seed for you to get to the Olympics. If I remember the part in the book correctly, it was a result of two volleyball teams were contesting whether the ball had been inside the court or outside the court. He explained, you know, all the differences, stuff like that. So that seed got planted at an early age. And then fast forward many years down the road, you accomplished your dream. How did you feel? Like, what was your raw emotion at that point?
Well, quite honestly, it was a relief because I was 39 years old, which is very old by the standards of Olympic sport. It was a record, actually. It was a Winter Olympic record, how old I was. And I knew it was my last chance. And I knew that I needed to be done. And I knew that the last two seasons, by the end of the competitive season, I had been exhausted, and I had injured myself here and there. And my last year, I was dealing with an injury that basically delayed my, at the start of the year, I thought, well, I'm not in race shape and the World Cup season is starting. This is not good, but ultimately it delayed my peak also. So it wasn't necessarily a bad thing, but I knew it was my last crack at it. And so I was elated and relieved that, you know, so many people dedicate their lives to sport. And if you're a professional athlete, then there's an income there also. But if you are an Olympian, it very likely is not something that puts food on the table. It's just something that you've dreamt of for your life. And that was true of me. And so very few athletes get the gift of being able to go out on top and having their best race, also being their last race. And so I was and am grateful and relieved and elated. That was how it was a rotation of those three.
Awesome. I'm just curious how you juggled your day job to get allow you the time for all the stuff you need to do for on the mental side, and also physical preparation, the travel commitments, because reading in the book, you're constantly on the road for world championships. How did you juggle it all to get to that point?
Well, being a firefighter is shift work. So it has the benefit of, you know, it'd be different than being a teacher, for example. If you're a firefighter, when your shift is over, it's over. And you go home and you don't worry about it until you're back on shift again. And so in a sense, that allowed me time to focus on other things. It was also the circuit isn't nearly as extensive as it is for skiing or speed skating, where often they will have a couple of World Cups and a World Championships after an Olympics in a given year. So for us, it was always very, you know, when I first started, it was 5 World Cups and a World Championships, and that expanded to 8 World Cups and a World Championships or an Olympics. So for my career, it was a very set, specific amount of time. And it was typically 3 or 4 World Cups before Christmas, 4 or 5 World Cups after Christmas, and then the big one, wherever that happened to be. And they would put them all back to back to back. So there'd be sort of a North American half and a European half, or maybe we'd go to Japan or Russia or something that wasn't, you know, in Russia is Europe, but it's nowhere near. All the other tracks are sort of clustered together in Switzerland, Germany, Austria, that sort of thing. So you tend to clump them all together. So you have 3 World Cups in 3 weeks. The season is, what I'm trying to say is the season is over before you know it. So there's an extensive off season. And I really took advantage of that to focus on the mental aspects of it and mentally rehearse, take photographs like the Torino track. Obviously, I knew years in advance that would be the most important race of my career. So I had resources. I took pictures. I took a good camera. I borrowed my wife's camera and took a photograph of the track every 3 meters from top to bottom and studied the photographs. And we had video and all of these things. And I really broke down the sport into its component parts and tried to get better. Every offseason, I tried to get better at every one of those component parts. So it was a very analytical way of looking at it. And as I say in the book, this, you know, I might be describing something that sounds very specific to skeleton, but that's the difference between hard work and passion. Hard work means when you're at the training session, you try hard and you exhaust yourself and you work very hard and you don't, you know, stop before your training done is, you know, you push your limits in the gym or on the field or on the pitch or whatever it is. Yeah. Passion is what I think I brought to the table or was largely responsible for my success, which was constantly daydreaming about one obscure aspect of my diet or recovery protocol or how it was going to change the welding on my sled so I better and more comfortably fit on it. You know, like there's no limit to what you can. I mean, for a skeleton, we always said when I joined bobsleigh first, and the same thing sort of applied to skeleton, they say a fast run is 1/3 push, 1/3 equipment, and 1/3 drive. And so I looked at every one of those component parts and said, how can I make my equipment better? And I had 3 or 4 things that I tried every year, and it involved testing. Sometimes I didn't know if it was going to work or not, but I was always innovating and always trying to make each one of those aspects and subcategories of each one of those aspects to make them better. Because in skeleton, you're on a constant search for tiny amounts of time. And so how I fit on the sled can make 1/100 of a second difference. You know, what the cut of the runner, what the bow of the runner can make 0.1 of a second difference. You know, so you're constantly experimenting, constantly trying something new. And most of the time it doesn't help. Most of the time it's a failure, but you've learned something. and it's a constant progression.
Let's talk about that point. Because setting up the question, it's almost like we're having this, our minds are in the same space, because the next question I was going to ask you was literally the importance of failure and reinforcing with your athletes, because shifting gears, you then go into coaching at that level, work with a lot of skeleton. The importance for making mistakes and having a safe environment to make those mistakes. What's your take on that?
Well, that's, the environment makes all the difference, because you get into, this is what I found as a coach. If someone does well, and after the fact, I mean, these days I would say psychology is my greatest interest. So the books I used to read were on sports psychology. And now that's progressed to just psychology, because it's all the same. It's all coming from the same pile. And what I noticed in my coaching career was something called self-serving bias. What I now know psychologists refer to as self-serving bias. And what that means is, and we all, you know, and I'm not pretending by any measure that I'm not guilty of it as well at times, but that's the nature of bias. It's easy to point out in other people. It's hard to see it in ourselves. But self-serving bias is when you do well, as you should, you take credit for it. And you say, well, yeah, I won that race, or I got a personal best finish in that race because I did this, this, and this. But when you do poorly as a defense mechanism, you tend to focus on the aspects of it that are beyond your control. And so that's something I talk a lot about in the book, because that doesn't serve you. You benefit from failure, but how do you undercut that process? You fail to take ownership for your mistakes. And I remember we talked about this the last time, actually. How do you not benefit from failure? You blame other people or circumstances or something other than yourself for your mistakes. And how do you benefit from failure? You learn from your mistakes. And it sounds like such an obvious statement. And it is such an obvious statement. But we have, you know, we have these defense mechanisms. And it's, I benefited hugely from my teammates and the environment, you know. And to your point, we would have conversations during training, after training, always analyzing, always from the perspective of, you know, not, oh, hey, I noticed your personal failure there. That's something that would never even cross our minds. It would be, where did you lose time there? What happened? Ah, okay, that's understandable. I appreciate that. Now we've learned something from it. And as a team, we all learned from each other's mistakes. And that was hugely valuable. And I watched, you know, it's one of the things that I wanted to make sure I got down and adequately described in the book, because I saw examples all around me. In one case of some of the athletes I coached, but definitely in other teams from around the world, the American team, when I was competing, not when I was coaching, but when I was competing, they had three athletes on the men's side who were all world champions at different times. So as elite as they could have possibly been, but they really had a personality. They didn't get along. They didn't like each other. They didn't pool their resources. And I benefited tremendously from having selfless teammates who had my best interest at heart. And part of the reason they did was because I had their best interest at heart. And I knew that if we pooled our resources, all of us would elevate. And we did.
The whole importance of selflessness, which is something I reinforce. There's nothing worse than a team sport when you have selfish players that don't buy into the importance of teamwork, right? And you obviously had a team that supported each other through that process, and look at what you were able to achieve. So from a coaching standpoint in en masse, what have you learned? And I think you're no longer coaching at the Olympic level. You've got dark horse and you're continuing to reinforce multi-sport, but what are some big tips? Cause Ted's actually piped in with a couple other queries. I'll ask the question shortly, but he said, that's a classic coaching tip, kind of piggybacking on what you're referencing on the controllables. Like if you own up and you accept, okay, I made a mistake. Most kids, they know when they made a mistake. It's that I guess the toxic world that we've kind of seen happen, you know, with maybe 10-15% of coaches not recognizing, hey, you know they made the mistake. You don't have to bark at them to the extent that we've seen, like the 8-year-old analogy that you shared about your son, kind of evolved to the point, okay, now we get it. Now we know the importance of the mistake. But on at the national level that you were coaching, did you foster, did you make that intentional with your athletes that you were coaching?
Yeah. Yes, because I think in part because we had, skeleton isn't an individual sport. And so you had a few people who came into that environment thinking that what they knew, they wanted to be protective of because their teammates were their competition. And so that was true. And I talk about this a lot in the book, was that was true of myself coming onto the team and Jeff Payne being the top dog before I got there. And so when I came to the team, athletically, I was ahead of him. And so what did he have over me? The technical aspect. Yeah. And so to him, and I probably, and as I say in the book, to his credit, he eventually came around. And to be fair about it, if I was in his shoes, I probably would have thought of exactly the same way. But he didn't want to, he didn't want to help me with all his technical knowledge because it would be creating the teammate who would just take over the top spot. Yeah. So eventually we learned that to be at the absolute highest level required everybody's input.
And it's getting the buy-in from all levels. And really the coach is the one that reinforces that premise, which kudos to you for having that environment when you're an athlete and then bringing that forward from a coaching perspective. There's a lot of Excel done under your watch as well.
Yeah. Well, you try. Right. And some of these positions are default positions and all you can do is reinforce it. And I think it was, do you know Jim Aframov? I think he wrote A Champion's Mind.
I haven't had a chance to read the book. I have a big, you know, I just got the Mindful Athlete from George Mumford. That's nice on my must read list.
Gotcha. Anyway, he said something about a survey of characteristics of, I thought it was the difference between gold medalists and everybody else, but I'm not, don't quote me on that. But one of the five characteristics that separated gold medalists from everybody else. And four of them, in my opinion, at least, were what you would expect, not really surprising or shocking statements, characteristics. But one I thought was really telling, and it was along the lines of what you just said, which is focused almost exclusively on factors that they can control and have no concern or worry about the factors that they can't control. And that's, I use, when I talk about that in the Tao of Sport, I use Sidney Crosby as an example. And it was interesting because I was watching I grew up in Toronto. I'm still a Leaf fan. And the Leafs were playing the Oilers last night and they had microphones on two of the players. And the Oiler was, you know, he was, and this is also a producer or an editor somewhere picking and choosing what they're saying or getting quotes from them. But the Oiler player was teasing his teammate and it was just chatter. And the Leaf player was like, okay, the next time that happens, you just go a little deeper on that and then we'll have the space there. In other words, they were entirely focused on the execution of the game, on the process. And I thought, you know, we all cherry pick the data that backs up what we already believe, right? But that was one small example. And I use Sidney Crosby as an example. Anytime I've ever seen him on the bench, he's having this super, you know, heated discussion with a line mate. And it's like, yeah, next time you're doing this and you go around there. It's always about the execution of the game. It's not, you know, complaining about the referee. That's not what a champion focuses on. It's what are we going to do differently next time? Because the goal is not to get a good body check or to humiliate an opponent. It's to score a goal. It's to be the best we can be. And there are examples of that at the highest level of sport in any sport.
The big analogy of your players over the years is you can't control the uncontrollables, right? You can only control what you can do as a player and as a team collectively. If we do that, then we're going to be okay. And you mentioned Sidney Crosby. He's probably very infamous for actually setting up plays on the ice and pulling everybody together before the play. And that happened in 2010. You know,
yeah.
Literally when that goal went in, it was right. Okay, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go down here. And it's pretty amazing. I've talked to people who actually saw that firsthand, had an opportunity to be on the ice. It's pretty amazing what happened in 2010. So let's shift gears on getting back to the book. And I don't know where this conversation go, because I know our last chat, we were at this for a while. Growth mindset, Carol Dweck. I know you're a big advocate for it. And you highlight the importance. How many athletes have you worked with personally that came into either Dark Horse or at the elite level that you coached? And that I can actually use the word elite, because I don't use the word elite for kids. I think that's a total misnomer. Olympics, Olympians, they're elite. But everything below that, they're just good. That's always been
yeah. Good. I always say, yeah, good. Compared to other 12-year-olds.
Yeah, they're good to good compared to other 12-year-olds, because the elite misnomer that is continuously being used is seen as low as 6, 7, 8-year-olds. Like, no, there's no elite at that age group. Just a kid that is kind of beyond the early bloomer stage, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But getting to the importance of reinforcing I'm not that good versus, which is fixed mindset, versus I'm not that good yet, which you proved it going to where you went from, you know, all the way up the pipeline. How important is that for coaches to reinforce both from their mindset when they're coaching, but also the player buying into that?
Well, it's interesting. And I've discussed this on my podcast, actually. If I go to a Dark Horse session, which is kids roughly ages 7 to 12, elementary aged kids, and I say, who here knows what a growth mindset is? Who here knows what a fixed mindset is? Kids typically know what that is, or can give you a rudimentary definition of what that is. Conversely, I've gone to teacher conferences, and I've said, you know, and where the growth versus fixed applies most is sports and school.
Yeah.
And you go to teacher conferences and I say, who here has read Carol Dweck's book? And in a room full of people, you would get one or two hands. And that's a very difficult thing for me to swallow, because it's not that simple. It's a semi-complicated issue. It's not just when I say, a growth mindset means if you work at something, you get better. Well, every kid knows that the minute you learn how to read, you know that. Where does the rubber hit the road? How does that actually translate into the real world? And where it translates, and this is an important chapter, this is chapter 4 in the Tao of Sport. What does that actually mean in the real world? It's how you look at failure. And so you want to foster a growth mindset. What you do is you stop making it entirely about who wins and who loses, because you want someone to be great. You need to challenge them. You have to have an athlete who wants to challenge themselves. How do you challenge yourself? By facing a tougher opponent. Well, what's most likely to happen if you face a tougher opponent? You're going to lose, but that's how you grow. And the summary of Carol Dweck's research was that a growth mindset was more effective. And ultimately, those who have a growth mindset are more successful because they're not afraid to lose. They're not afraid to challenge themselves in a tougher environment. And what we're doing without realizing it, in very obvious ways and in very subtle ways, is teaching kids that you don't want to play the good team. You either want to be on the good team for tryouts, and you try out to be on the highest team you can, but you don't want to play the good team because that's humiliating. That's what we're teaching kids. And very slowly and methodically and repeatedly, I've tried to teach my kids that the greatest joy, the greatest excitement, the greatest high you can get in sport is when you challenge and give the top team and the best players a run for their money. That's certainly one of the most exciting things that I see in my kids. That's the greatest joy that I have. And it's easy for me to see that. And when I read Carol Dweck's book, I went, yep. I remember. Yep. And it's because of my dad. It's because ever since I was very young. And when I was very young, I did judo. So before I was even out of elementary school, I did judo, which was his sport. And if the way judo works is you compete against people who have the same belt color as you. So it's based on experience, not necessarily age, not necessarily ability level. And so sometimes, when you're a yellow belt, you go against someone else who is completely out of your league, but also a yellow belt. And there were times then I have this vivid memory of a girl, I don't know how old I would have been, but a girl who was way bigger than me, but a yellow belt also. And she just, wiped the mat with me. And my dad laughing that it was funny and reassuring me that everything was fine and that, you were going up against someone who is way better than you. And I hope you learned something. And look, you're okay. Life goes on. It's not a big deal. He wasn't laughing at me. He was laughing at the fact that I was nervous, but it's just sport and it's fine. And I was reinforced with that mindset from like the first minute I can remember to this point. And so that's, how you relate to failure, that's it. And in very obvious ways, with regard to our kids, if you're happy because your kid won and not as happy because your kid's team lost, you're giving them a message. And it's, do I expect parents not to be happy when their kids score a goal or win? No. But let's not pretend it's not a message. And let's, and the solution that I've found as a workaround for that is that I cheer and my wife cheers, and there are a few other families in the baseball. This is my own personal experience. In the baseball community, I see that every once in a while. I see other families who cheer good plays. And I don't see it as often in hockey. It's just, we'll cheer for our side and I got nothing to say when the other team does well. That's what I've noticed. But that's a workaround. And what you, bottom line is, how do you foster a growth mindset? You focus on growth. You focus on challenge.
And you kind of, I guess an emotional sore spot for me, because growing up, I had an amazing, my mother passed away a number of years ago. And she was my biggest supporter. Lost my father when I was a really young age. So she tried to come to many of my games, many of my brother's games, played a whole bunch of different sports. But she was one of those parents that, based on her upbringing, because she had a lot of brothers growing up, was clapping and praising great plays, regardless of whose team made it. And I'll never forget when I was in the provincials in football, the first one we went to, which we ended up winning, she was clapping when the other team was making great tackles and passes. And after the game, I said, Mom, like, really? She goes, but it was so much fun watching that game of the competition, and your team played great and you played great and the other kids played great. But that's where the shift has happened. Now nobody's praising the effort, the level of the competition. Is it's really about how you play the game, right? When it comes down to it. So we don't have much time left. There's one question I didn't ask you. I will, and anybody that's watching this, do you have any other asks? Are you tight for time, Duff? How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good.
Okay. So Ted asked a question. This goes back to when we were talking about the juggling act of being a fireman and playing at the national level. Didn't your employer have to be supportive so you'd be able to do that? And what did they do to accommodate your travel and being at the national level?
The employer does have to be supportive. I think it was the nature of the job to a certain extent. But I had support from individuals within the fire department who said, look, this guy is going to the Olympics and he's representing our department. And I got a few, I think they gave me, instead of instead of switching my holidays, I think they gave me a week and a half off or something along those lines to do it. So support in general, in very general terms, is an important thing. And I had coworkers. I had a coworker actually who, for my second Olympics, he worked a day for me. He worked a shift for me. He donated. I still think of that very fondly, as he donated a day of his life to come to work so I didn't have to, and he won't let me pay him back. And that's that just makes me feel, I get an emotional reaction just thinking of that. That's such a supportive thing and a wonderful thing. But support is obviously not just your employer. It's your my wife. It's I didn't have kids back then. My wife is just doing a little dance off screen there, taking some credit, some well-deserved.
Without the wives, we don't get to where we go, right? Really, the support network and your employers and your teammates, like, you have the support to get to that level. And that really is the day. That's really what we all need. I've talked to several Olympic athletes that financially it's a tough go because there's not a lot of financial support for all the sports. There are for some, but not for all of them. And if you had not had a day job, it probably would have been very difficult for you to achieve your aspirations, right?
Yes.
So with those day jobs being supportive and you're playing and representing Canada, that must have been a big celebration when you got back to the fire hall, I imagine.
It was. And I have photographs of we landed, and then because I actually worked at the airport at the time, so I was an airport firefighter, and we have these big fire airport fire crash trucks. They're called crash trucks. I don't know if that's appropriate to call them that in the public, although crashes almost never happen. And they escorted the plane to the terminal after we landed. And of course, I have a few pictures of that somewhere. And the pilot said over the speaker inside the plane, just so you know, nothing's on fire, but we have a firefighter here on board who's just won a gold medal. And there was a clap, and it was a pretty cool scene.
Yeah, it can be. And when you achieve your goal, it's nothing better. I remember when I won the gold medal in the summer games in rugby, it was huge. And the letters that followed and all the kudos that we got from everybody in our community was pretty cool. So we're wrap up time. From your coaching, your parenting, your high level, the book, there's so many nuggets in it. And I'm plugging it for you. If you got a video, you'll get to share it. It's definitely a great read. Tips.
Thank you, Glenn.
Parents to help their kids thrive in sport without focusing on winning at all costs. What would they be?
Well, I like to just think of it in as simple terms as possible. And that, not to plug my book, but I thought those chapters in the book were really, really important because you can justify whatever you want. I'm pushing him. I heard someone say, I want my kid to cry after they lose because that shows me they want to win. You have all this kind of, we'll justify the strangest things in our minds if we think it will make our kids better. And so I love what you say all the time, which is don't be your kid's last coach. That's from a coaching perspective. What does that tell me? They have to want to come back. They have to enjoy the environment. Okay, whatever that takes, don't be a kid's last coach. I love to watch you play is another one, which is completely independent of whether they won or lost. And as I intimated to you, I'd rather my kids lost, but put up a heck of a game against a better opponent. That's much more exciting than they beat the worst team in the league. That's a waste of, when someone wins 10-0, that's a waste of everybody's time, in my opinion. So thinking.
The total extreme. I shared this out a couple of years ago, I think, Ontario. There was a U8 game in hockey that was 42-0. I don't know if you ever saw that in any social media. I was like, what? They kept track of all the goals, even though on the scoreboard,
6-0.
It was 6-0. And you imagine the goalie of that 42, that velocity, never going in the net again. And I couldn't believe they let that game go without, let's just play shin. Let's just drop all the sticks and we'll spread out the teams and blah, 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 change the goalies. You're supposed to make that 8 years old. It showed that that was really, the focus was the score sheet. Instead, the focus should be about kids having fun. So they play for a very, very long time. So let's loop on the, giving the parent tip. And then the love watching you play, you know, for me is very personal because that's what my mom used to say to me all the time. Coach tip or tips, what would they be for those that are just kind of getting started? Because I, you know, this past year and a half of clinics going online, I've probably had over 1,000 coaches in clinics. And I've given them a lot of nuggets. I'm just wondering what you would share to help them save time off their learning curves. What would they be? Or what would they be?
One that took me a while to learn, and so you might consider this a more advanced concept, but it hits to the heart of what coaching is this. What you bring to the table is not relevant except through the eyes of what the athlete needs. So I can, I'm worried we're going to get cut off here. Can I jump into a story about that?
Yeah, go ahead. We're on your time. If you've got time, I've got time. I'm loving this conversation. So
I just mentioned, try
to do it at 60 minute, but there are still some people watching this. So
So there is an athlete who was a teammate of mine, and when I made the switch to coaching, she was still competing. And so that's a certain relationship that obviously I'm not going to be. You should do this, you should do this, you should do this. And I, and because she was a very accomplished world medalist slider. And on the first race that I actually coached her, in the debrief after the fact, she said, "You were so intense and it just made me nervous. I couldn't handle your intensity." And initially I wrote it off because I knew that was not factually correct. I wasn't, you know, nervous for her. I was providing what I thought she needed and then keeping my mouth shut because that's what I need as an athlete. I don't need some kind of pep talk at the top of a skeleton track. I needed, from a coach was have my sled there ready when it's time for me to go. And then get out of the way and shut up. That's kind of what that sounds very dismissive or disrespectful to a coach, but that's what I provided in this first experience with this athlete. And her comment to me after was, as I say, you were just so intense and it was just, it just exuded intensity from you. It was too much. I couldn't handle it. And as I say, initially I wrote it off because I knew that wasn't true. I was just keeping my mouth shut and getting out of her way. But it occurred to me after that it didn't matter whether I was actually intense or not. What mattered was what she needed from a coach. And so that progressed to, I'll tell you a little joke or a little lighthearted conversation to make sure you're in the right headspace when you go. Because how I did it and how she did it were two different things. And it didn't matter how I did it. It was more relevant what worked best for her. Now, you could have a discussion as to maybe she should try a different approach. Maybe the approach she had wasn't perfect, but maybe it was. And the bottom line is what was best for me. All of these things and why I think people should invest in sports psychology and the mental aspects of sport is that they are all unique to you. And therefore, as a coach, your first and main job, I would say, is understanding, getting to know and understanding the wants and needs and what motivates your athletes.
Yeah, nail on the head, that infamous connection piece, getting to know them as individuals first, then athletes second. On that note, in the book, I thought it was interesting. You're not a big fan of listening to music before a competition because it takes away from that mental focus, whereas it's kind of become a thing in a lot of sports where the earbuds and the large headphones and everybody's listening to music. With the mindset for you, it actually was more of a distraction than a motivator. Explain.
Well, again, to tie that into the point that I just made, I can't say that the music wasn't the absolute best thing for certain people at certain times. For what I was doing, that being skeleton, it is a tremendously technical, specific, fine thing that you have to do. If what I was going to do was a sprint, if what I was going to do was something where the technique was long since established, no problem, no change in environment, then maybe the music would have been totally perfect. For me also, I, as an older athlete, I needed to be absolutely in touch with my physical self. And if there was any tightness in a hamstring, for example, I needed to be aware of it. I needed to be completely in tune with the progression of my warm-up. And I thought that music might interfere with that. Now, for a younger athlete, maybe that's not an issue at all. Again, it's specific to the individual, and I can't say that it isn't the perfect thing for someone else. But I've always, you know, Back in Black gets you to the right headspace for what you have to do as an athlete, yeah, then by all means, then that's great. But for what I had to do it as an athlete, I was able to do it myself. And it had to do with the correct sequencing of the correct types of warm-ups and nervous system priming mixed in. Like, there was a lot you have to do to get ready to do the perfect skeleton run. And so I was in my own head, and music would have been a distraction. But I don't pretend that it wouldn't be great for doing something else, which I used to do as a younger man, or for someone else or a different activity.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's all, you're setting it up basically for closure in this, what could be a 4-hour, 5-hour, however many hours we could probably be chatting on the mindset piece, which is really what the book is all about. And the space between the ears, right? That's 6 to 8 inches, depending on how big your head is. And that all importance that, fortunately, and it is coming, that now a lot of sports are recognizing that needs to be part of the coaching curriculum. That needs to be part at all levels, in the youth sports, all the way to high performance, everything in between. But for the longest time, it was all skills, drills, tactics, and strategies. Coaches, for sure. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, Glenn, if you don't mind me jumping in to add to that point, is I went to, maybe a month ago now, a friend of mine asked me to speak to his baseball camp, and they had different age groups. And I was talking about, you know, I said to each group, okay, you're facing the best pitcher in the league, and you're going up there. Here's mindset number one. I hope I don't strike out. Here's mindset number two. Everyone thinks this guy is the greatest thing, but I dare him to throw one down the middle. And if they do, I'm going to destroy it. That's mindset number two. So I asked each group, I said, which one of those is more likely to be successful? And without hesitation, everyone says, I dare you to throw down the middle mindset. And then question number two from me to them was, have you ever thought of that before? Have you ever had a coach who asked you to think about that before? And it was crickets. In every age category, in every kid, no one had ever, that had never even crossed their mind, let alone was a part of a coach's curriculum. So it's what I found as a coach at an Olympic level is that it's very difficult to detrain someone who hasn't thought about it in a productive way when they're not a kid. So when you're a kid, you've got to establish these sorts of things, or at least start thinking about these kinds of things. And overwhelmingly, we don't. And I've coached people at the Olympic level who had never thought of these kind of things ahead of when they needed them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's because we weren't planting the seed early. And the earlier we do it, the sooner that they build that into their overall development and training, and hopefully will continue to move up the pipeline. And not wanting to end this conversation because I'm pretty sure we could keep doing a deep dive. I'll ask you one last question because I thought it was interesting in the book. One of the exercises you've done with hockey teams, and you've asked them
how many trivia losses, question.
Yeah, how many losses did the team that won the Stanley Cup have that season? You went through a whole list. What led you to asking that question? I'm curious. And how effective has it been with teams you've had that conversation with?
Well, that's typically something I ask at Dark Horse. But I have I do speak to kids' hockey teams every once in a while, and I've asked them as well. And the question for your listeners, the question is, I always set it up this way. I say, in a non-shortened season, so the last two seasons have been shortened.
Yeah.
In a non-shortened season, you play 82 games. You have overtime and a shootout if it's still a tie at the end of regulation. So someone wins every single game. Therefore, an average team, by definition, will win 41 and lose 41. We're talking about losing. How many times do you think the Stanley Cup champions lost if an average team will lose 41? And then I list the previous six, I think, Stanley Cup champions and how many times they lost in the season that they won the Stanley Cup. And I ask the kids to guess, knowing that an average team will lose 41 times. And that I remember one year when Washington won. And it was like, how many times, who won the Stanley Cup last year? I remember this conversation. Who won the Stanley Cup last year? And they're so proud to tell you, it was the Washington Capitals. That's right. Okay, so how many times do you think they lost in the regular season last year? And they're like, 12? 15? And then the one kid will gauge my reaction and then go a few more in a certain direction, depending on what they think my reaction to the first answer was. And it was all in the teens. And the answer was, I don't remember what it was for Washington specifically, but I think it was 33 or 35 losses. When an average team loses 41, they still lost 35 times. And that's the point, is that, and that's somewhat unique to hockey. Like the champ in basketball won't lose that many times, but that's, so it is, it makes a better point in hockey, because if you have a really good goalie, you're going to lose to a team that you're much better than if they have a really good goalie. That's the nature of hockey a little bit. But it's, the point is that it surprises people how much, what's professional sport all about? Winning. Okay, well, they're the Stanley Cup champions. Do you think they hardly ever lose? No, they lost almost as often as they won the year they won the Stanley Cup. So it's really about reacting to it and learning from it. That's the point of that exercise.
And that was why I wanted to set it up for closure on this conversation, because the unfortunate reality in the youth sports system, professionalism, whatever, has all been about that holy grail, chasing the wins, when we can learn so much from the losses and help us develop as individuals. So, Duff, I can't thank you enough, and kudos again. I'm going to plant the seed again. Read the book. I'm telling you, it's beginning to end. I found it a fast read too, because obviously I'm drinking your same Kool-Aid you have been drinking for many years. Kudos for everything you do at Dark Horse, and I hope your book really starts to explode. And enjoy the chat immensely. Down below the banner, if you want to reach out, correct me if I'm wrong, Dark Horse Athletic is your program you do aside from your firefighting, and doing great work on physical literacy and multi-sport participation, planning athleticism. Got a couple of comments, and I neglected to say this, and I'm not going to assume, I'm just going to read it. When we were talking about the support network, Carrie Gibson Pyatt said, your sister. So just to give you a little rub on that front.
That's my sister, yeah.
Okay, because I'm looking at Gibson, so I'm assuming there's a relation there. And then last but not least, from Ted, thanks for the interview and for the book. Great to see you. So I enjoyed the conversation.
Ted would be a good guest on this program, actually. He's enjoying the same Kool-Aid that we are, Glenn.
Good. Hopefully we'll get critical mass sooner or later, because it's amazing how many people I still talk to, like, oh, my son. I'm like, I don't even want to go there. I want to talk about the positives. So enjoy the chat, Duff. So hopefully a good end of the day. Get some lunch because we kind of ran into your lunch hour. Enjoy the conversation. So good luck with getting the book out to the masses.
Thanks so much, Glenn. Very, very much enjoyed it. As you stated, if I didn't have a clock ticking right on the screen in front of me, I would have guessed we'd be at a half an hour at this point. So
yeah, no,
we enjoyed it very much.
I truly did. I'm glad we circled back. It's been a while since we connected. So
yeah,
good luck.
Thank you, and to you.
Thanks, Jeff.